Well, good afternoon, Juno. It's 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News. It's time for Juno Afternoon. Pat Moore hosting the program today. Jeremy Johnson's going to drop by and tell us a little bit about the upcoming leadership training program for the CERT program. This is Preparedness Month, and we're getting prepared for all kinds of bad things that could happen to Juno. So this is training for folks on a team like that. Weather preparedness, another section of the show, and that'll be our sustainability segment today. Jeffrey Oshinsky and Miss Amy Fish will be coming in, and they're from the National Weather Service talking about weather preparedness. And Lori Scandlin will be here to tell us about the AVID tutor program in the schools. Weather looks like, lovely. Partly cloudy, sunny like this, probably through Saturday. Can you imagine? Let's get the gardens picked.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Colville tribal officials say they're optimistic a solution can be found to clean up mining pollution in the Upper Columbia River from a Canadian company. Steve Jackson reports.
For decades, the company now known as Tech Resources has operated a smelter in Trail, British Columbia. And throughout that period, mining waste was dumped into the Columbia River, making its way to the U.S. side of the border. In recent years, the Colville Confederated Tribes brought a suit against the company, demanding that it pay for studies and eventual cleanup of the material called slag, which is believed related to a number of health problems. Last week, the company avoided a protracted trial by admitting its pollution had been released into the U.S. environment. Colville Tribal Chairman John Cyrus sees the move as a positive step, but he says it will take much more work to revive the health of the river.
You know, we're tied to that river. We're tied to the health of that river. And we see the health impacts that have happened from the effluent and the runoff of that heavy metal dumping into the Columbia River. And we're not at a point where we can, you know, tie those directly to those heavy metals, but mm-hmm. certainly when you have higher percentages of cancer and other health maladies that come about from heavy metal exposure, it's a huge concern.
A Tech Resources spokesman says studies paid for by the company so far do not indicate that the slag has harmed water quality or had a negative impact on fish. The next phase of the story is a trial set to begin next month to determine if U.S. Superfund law can apply to the Canadian-based company. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
Last week, 10 North and Central Coast First Nations in British Columbia, Canada announced a ban on trophy hunting of grizzly and black bears in their traditional territories. Lisa Hale has more.
Coastal First Nations say that trophy hunting is a safety issue for people on the land and that it threatens the ecotourism that the nations are developing. The North and Central BC Coast is known as the Great Bear Rainforest. It's the home of the Kermode, or spirit bear, a black bear that has a unique light-colored coat caused by a recessive gene. Doug Nislas, chief of the Kitisu Hehes, says trophy hunting conflicts with the cultural values of coastal First Nations. Grizzly and black bear hunting is only permitted by the province in certain parts of the Great Bear Rainforest. This year, the government of BC has issued 32 hunting authorizations for grizzlies on the coast, and hunters can each kill up to 2 black bears. No spirit bears can be taken. Chief Nislas says that conservation is a key issue. He points out that shooting a black bear could be killing one that's carrying the spirit bear gene. Forests and Lands Minister Steve Thompson says that the province has a responsibility for setting the harvest limits, and he asks First Nations to respect that authority, according to a statement from his office. William Housty of the Heiltsik Nation disagrees.
Well, my reaction is the province can claim all the authority they want, but as coastal First Nations people, we've never ceded any of our territory to anybody, so our authority is just as much as the province or any other agency that has authority in this area in the Great Bear Rainforest.
Housty says that the Coastal First Nations Guardian Watchman Program will be patrolling to monitor and enforce the trophy hunt ban. For National Native News, I'm Lisa Hale in Vancouver.
And now for a correction, on our Monday history segment, we said the Rosebud Sioux Tribe held a groundbreaking ceremony for its Veterans Center, when in fact it was for its Veterans Cemetery. During this week in 1778, Delaware people, also known as Lenape, signed a treaty with the United States. They were among the first Indians to come in contact with Europeans in the early 1600s. Their traditional territory was on the East Coast, but many were forced to move westward through a handful of states. Some groups settled in present-day Oklahoma, and others fled to Canada. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Tune in to Friends and Neighbors on Wednesday to re-experience the concert Marion Call did for KRNN at the Gold Town Theater on June 13th. The theater was sold out as Marion, backed up by her father Paul, entertained us in a two-hour concert and interview. If you miss the concert or want to hear it again, we have a front row seat reserved for you on Friends and Neighbors, Wednesday, September 19th, 7 to 9 p.m. on KRNN.
It's kind of like KRNN week around here with the Singer-Songwriter Showcase coming up. It's September 26th. It's 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. It'll be at the Gold Town Theater. Liz Snyder, Brooke Morgan, Dean Frank, and Irene Miller will host. Will be hosted by Angela Ahrens. The tickets are reasonable. They're at the usual places. You can get them at the station or at the door. The snacks are on the house, and beer and wine will be for sale. These events have been very successful in the past, and we'll give you a little taste of what you'll be hearing here. Here is music by Dean Frank.
This song right here is called Old Thing. Wrote it when I was traveling through the West. Something about the old beauty out there makes you nostalgic. And it made me realize that there's a representation of ill doings in this world that have become accepted. So take it as sarcasm. Take it as sincere. The message still rings true. These are old things. Like the musket balls and arrowheads dug up by children. In every generation there are Native men and there are pilgrims. And these are old things. And these are old things. Like the pyramids of Egypt and Babel his tower. Men have always tried to rival God and his power. And these are old things. And these are old things. So the conscience we carry, Lord, it cannot be heavy, as these are old things. Like the purple heart in my dresser drawer. There was a war and there will be more. And these are old things. And these are old things. Like the pocket watch on a widow's shelf that keeps on ticking. Time is one of the hardest things to reconcile with. And these are old things. And these are old things. So the conscience we carry, Lord, it cannot be heavy. These are old
music by one of the people who will be part of the Singer-Songwriter Showcase on September 26th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Goldtown Theater. It's sponsored by KRNN Radio and Alaska Communications and Northwind Architects. That was Dean Frank. Also on the program will be Liz Snyder, Brooke Morgan, and Irene Miller, all together at that fine event on September 26th from 7 to 9 p.m. This Saturday at 7 p.m., at the JDS Auditorium, JDS Drama will be putting on the Trashin' Fashion Show. This is a small version of the Wearable Arts. And what's happening here is that both students and teachers have designed and made and will be modeling original clothing that is all made out of recyclable material. And the program features the JDHS cheerleaders, JDU dancers, and the Juno jumpers, as well as others. So it's a big performance. It'll be a very magical, fun evening. There's a bake sale going on at the same time. And all of this is being done as a fundraiser because JDHS is going to the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh, Scotland. And they're raising money for that, as well as raising money for the AYEA Environmental Club at JDS. So come out and support the high school students for Trashin' Fashion Show on Saturday at 7 p.m.
This is Bird Note. Listen. Swainson's thrushes are calling to one another while flying at night. Two-thirds of migrating birds fly at night, making it a challenge to track their movement. Dr. Andrew Farnsworth, a researcher at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, is using advances in technology to learn when birds migrate and where they stop, feed, and rest.
We're using bioacoustics and radar together, as well as observational data from people and meteorological data, and really combining all of these things together. So the acoustics tells you very well about what species are migrating at night and where they are. But if a single microphone, for example, is very poor at telling you how many individuals, because one bird may call multiple times, some birds are not calling. Radar, on the other hand, is wonderful at telling you how many things are up there. So how many birds? Where are they? How fast are they moving? What direction are they going? So using the two things together, and understanding how they relate to one another is a really exciting frontier that in the next few years is going to have some tremendous power in terms of our ability to forecast and analyze how migrants pass through a space and where they are when and what particular stopover habitat and places are important.
To hear flight calls and see radar representing millions of birds on the move, begin at our website, birdnote.org.
It's 15 minutes after 3. You're in tune with KTOO News. KTOO reminds you that there is an upcoming municipal election. It's scheduled for Tuesday, October 2nd. The reason we're reminding you so early is because one of the responsibilities of voting is to find out about the candidates and how they stand on the issues. So the League of Women Voters has arranged with KTOO to invite you to a municipal candidate forum. That will be tonight at 7 p.m. It's in the Assembly Chambers. It's moderated by Barbara Belknap. Now, if you can't make it to that forum, you can hear it on KTOO News because we'll be broadcasting it live tonight at 7, live from the Assembly Chambers right here on 104.3 FM.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, September the 18th, 2012. It's the birthday of Dr. Johnson, Samuel Johnson, born Litchfield, England, 1709, sickly child, but very intelligent, and when he decided to get married at the age of 25, he set out in search of an intelligent wife. He found one in a woman who was 21 years older than he, a widow. She had three children. Elizabeth Porter Jervis was her name. He called her Teddy. And when she met Johnson, she said to her daughter, "That is the most sensible man I ever met." Samuel Johnson, who said, "Marriage has many pains, but celibacy has no pleasures." It was on this date, 1793, George Washington put on his ceremonial Masonic sash and apron and laid the cornerstone for the Capitol building in Washington. Tiffany and Company was founded in New York City on this date, 1837. Stationery and fancy goods emporium. Abraham Lincoln bought jewelry for his wife at Tiffany's. And Truman Capote made it famous with his novella Breakfast at Tiffany's. Holly Golightly, his heroine, takes a cab down to Tiffany's whenever she's feeling low. She says, "It calms me down right away, the quietness and the proud look of it. Nothing very bad could happen to you there. Not with those kind men in their nice suits and that lovely smell of silver and alligator wallets." It's the birthday of the actress and playwright Anna Deavere Smith, born Baltimore, 1950, known for her one-woman shows in which she chooses a contemporary event, does extensive interviews with people involved, and then turns them into characters. She did one about the Rodney King beating in Los Angeles, another about the Crown Heights riots in Brooklyn. It's the birthday of Greta Garbo, born Greta Gustafsson in Stockholm, 1905. Grew up poor. She was shy. Her father died when she was 15. She had to go to work to help support the family. She became a department store model, went to study at the Royal Dramatic Theater, and caught the eye of a movie director, Moritz Stiller. He took her under his wing, changed her last name to Garbo, cast her in a movie, and when he signed a deal with MGM in Hollywood, he insisted on bringing her along. She became a big star with the movie Flesh and the Devil, 1926, a movie at which she met and fell for her co-star John Gilbert. They went on to star in a silent film adaptation of Anna Karenina and several more features. They got engaged. Garbo called off the wedding at the last minute, and she never married. She traveled. She had many close friends. She loved New York City, though she did guard her privacy. People quoted the line that she spoke in the movie Grand Hotel, but they misquoted it, and Garbo once pointed out, "I never said, 'I want to be alone.' I only said, 'I want to be let alone.' There is all the difference." Here's a poem for today by Faith Sheeran, "Picking the Kitten." You had to hold it a while in your hand. It was important to look into the box of blind fur and notice who needed you. Not the one who chased its tail, not the one who slept in a corner with an air of indifference. There were colors and markings to consider. Which would you want to find on your pillow? The one I took home was warm as fever. I held her purr in my pocket, her roughness on my bedroom rug. I pour out this memory the way I poured out her evening cream. "Picking the Kitten" by Faith Sheeran, from her collection Moving the Piano, published by Stephen F. Austin State University Press, used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac, produced by Nick Vedder, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
More than 7,000 kids drop out of school every day.
Every year, over 1 million of us drop out.
One of us won't graduate from high school on time.
You know the problem.
If I drop out, I'm 8 times likelier to go to prison.
And what it costs.
There's a 4 in 10 chance that I'll need welfare.
Find out what you can do.
Watch American Graduate Day.
It's a live nationwide outreach event.
We can change the statistics.
Become an American Graduate ally.
American Graduate Day on 360 North, Saturday the 22nd at 9.
I'm a roving cowboy, riding all day long. Tumbleweeds around me, hear my lonely song. Nights underneath a prairie moon, I ride along and sing a tune.
See them tumble and down, pledging their love to the ground. Lonely but free I'll be found, drifting along with the tumble and tumble.
The group is Riders in the Sky, and they're doing a concert that's coming up. Let's see, it's coming up on Monday. Monday at 7 p.m. It's in the JDHS Auditorium. So if you're into the old timey Western music, these guys are masters of it. 7 p.m. JDS Auditorium on Monday. Mm-hmm. So we started the first week in September doing some sections of the show on the subjects of sustainability and with that, the concomitant word of preparedness and things like that. So we're going to sort of depart from some of the things we've talked about on the sustainability segments, although this is about sustaining ourselves. I'm lucky enough to have two people with me here who are from the National Weather Service visiting Juneau, and I'm hoping that we can maybe talk a little bit about some of the things. Jeffrey Oshinsky is here. He's the Deputy Chief of the National Weather Service Environmental and Scientific Services Division, and Amy Fish is with us. She's the Decision Support Strategies Implementation Manager, an interesting title. So welcome to Juneau, folks.
Thank you.
Great.
Beautiful
Thanks
to be here today.
Yeah.
Do we have typical Juneau weather for you while you're here? The sun shines down here all the time, you know.
We've heard that rumor, yeah.
Yeah. However, we are very grateful for the fact that we're having such a wonderful weekend coming up. While I have you here, I wanted to know, first of all, what Decision Support Strategies Implementation Managers do.
It's actually a new position within Alaska Region for the National Weather Service.
Okay.
And essentially it's, in, if you will, kind of trying to usher in a culture change in the way that we think about how we serve the customer. For example, emergency managers, people who are in charge of safety of the public. And, you know, often in the past, you know, we issue products and we hit a button and it kind of goes into, you know, the black hole of wherever it disseminates, and people receive that information in various different ways. And we're looking into now learning more, not just about, you know, how high is the wind going to blow, but what can that do? And that's not always the same answer every day. I'm sure, for example, you've probably heard that Anchorage has had some high wind events, and they're not particularly outrageously strong winds for Anchorage, but they come at a time where the ground is saturated because of heavy rain, the leaves are full on the trees, so they're acting like sails, and the ground's not frozen. So the windstorm that we're getting in September is not the same flavor of the same windstorm that would be happening in January. So we're trying to focus more on what are the impacts of just these numbers that as scientists we forecast, and then also trying to reach out better. You know, in this information day of age, it's difficult to sometimes cut through the clutter and get your message straight straight to the person that needs it the most, because we're all bombarded with so much information.
Thanks, Amy. I think that clarifies what I was confused about with the position. You use two interesting terms in the way you talk about what you do, and that is product and client. I don't think that I think I have to shift gears to think about the Weather Service as seeing me as a client and delivering a product.
As a customer, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, the taxpayer is our customer, and especially when we engage with folks that are making decisions to save the lives of the locals in the community. I mean, that's, you know, you think about it. I mean, we're in the business of customer service. We all are. And, you know, it's our job to try to meet their needs the best. And, you know, it's kind of an important job. How can we best meet your need as someone who's in charge of public safety to help save people? You know, that's kind of how we think of it.
Huh. Jeffrey, you do you're the chief of the scientific and Environmental Services Division. How does that mesh with the rest of the Weather Service?
Well, I guess my position is more to help provide support for a lot of our field offices throughout the state, which Juneau is one of our forecast offices, and working with Amy closely in our regional office to help get this message of Decision Support Services implemented in Alaska. I think it's really important, and kind of along that same theme, you know, we're working a lot with the state of Alaska, the Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, working more closely with them to provide direct support during these high-impact storms that affect any part of the state. So anytime there's a major weather system that could cause serious impacts and damage, potential damage, they'll pool resources of other local, state, and federal partners together in the State Emergency Operations Center in Anchorage, and we're now part of that operation and help to provide tailored information to those customers and make sure that we have sort of a single voice within the National Weather Service.
Now, Juneau and a lot of Southeast Alaska is sheltered. And so I think we tend to kind of think that we are immune from weather disasters, or we're protected from them. How true is that?
Ooh, I don't think maybe is as true as maybe folks are led to believe. I think that every place has its unique potential disasters. In Juneau, of course, strong winds can be an issue, and some winds can be stronger than others. And certainly, again, as Amy pointed out in her example, depending on the time of the year and the direction of the wind can have certain impacts in certain areas. So we need to sort of be careful and not make general statements, I don't think, necessarily to say, well, we're safe here necessarily. I think we need to probably look at what the potential hazards are and to look each and every storm sort of individually to see what the potential impacts can be and make sure we reach out to the right people so that the message is disseminated properly so people can take action.
So what is the warning system? In other words, assume that, I mean, we have these things called the Taku winds, and we're kind of used to seeing our neighbor's roof go down the street, early in the morning. So if it's going to be worse than that, how are we going to know?
We were actually just talking about that just a few minutes ago. There are many different ways to get the warning out. And, you know, if something is going to be critically bad and out of the ordinary, you know, I mean, obviously Juneau is a high wind area, but when you have an event that looks like it could be out of the ordinary, there are many ways that the forecasters and the forecast office can get that message out. Some of the most effective means is to pick up the phone, whether it's to an emergency manager, as we talked about earlier, or it's to get the folks in the media involved to say, here, this is why we think this is going to be not your typical Taku event. And if you could help us spread the word, that would be great. There's the emergency alert system, so EAS, not necessarily issued for certainly your typical high wind event. But, you know, there's various different ways. And, you know, the Weather Service is, we can't do our job alone, and we absolutely know that, recognize that, and you in the media, frankly, are one of the best assets, the best partners we have to get alerts and warnings out to the public.
Well, I know we have the EAS, and periodically in the middle of something that we're doing here, suddenly the beep tones will sound and we'll test the EAS. What would it take? Can you give me a scenario that would actually cause that thing to activate for real?
A slew of different things could, I mean, and many of them are not even weather related. For example, amber alerts, those can trigger EAS.
What?
Amber alerts. So that would be a child that's been abducted.
Oh, okay. All right.
There could be, let's say, something catastrophic happens and it's an ammonia leak and an area needs to be evacuated. That could go out over the EAS system, and that would pass through the National Weather Service Forecast Office in Juneau, and they would issue that alert. Avalanche, that's a big issue, right, for Juneau. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the messages that would go over EAS. So they're not necessarily weather-related. I know one that triggered recently that Joel, the warning coordination meteorologist, was telling us about locally was recently you had lightning events, and that was an issue with some of the wind and the hail that was involved with mariners over the water, and so that triggered EAS. So various different events can, but they have a thoroughly vetted plan with what's called the LECC, so that is the Local Emergency Communications Committee, and so it's, you know, various entities from officials who are, again, in charge of public safety, the National Weather Service, media in the community, and a thoroughly vetted plan to make sure that they're hitting the things that are important to this community.
So we've talked about the possibilities of things, of preparing for things like avalanche, high wind events, and that sort of thing. What dangers are there from the sea, that since we are a seacoast community?
Absolutely. There are several. you know, there's Juneau and the whole Southeast Panhandle is really subject to the potential for local tsunamis. Various areas, underwater landslides can cause rapid rises in water and could generate a local tsunami. And you know, it's interesting if you take a look at a Google Earth image and you kind of zoom in on the panhandle, you can actually see some of the fault lines that run through the southeast, which are very interesting. And those fault lines actually are areas where there's a potential for earthquake activity and movement. And, you know, the Earth has its way of releasing pressure through earthquakes, and it's, you know, if you look at the panhandle and look at certain areas have had earthquakes more frequently than others. So kind of the thinking behind that is, you know, these areas that maybe haven't had earthquakes in a while, the pressure may be building, so there's the potential, obviously, that we could have earthquake activity which could trigger an underwater landslide or any kind of a landslide that could cause a locally generated tsunami.
Jeffrey, if I were looking at that Google Earth map, how would I see the fault lines?
You can actually see, it's interesting, you can actually see lines that almost look like small ridges that kind of extend through the geography. They're very straight, but they come in at different angles. And those lines are generally associated with faults, and faults are typically where earthquakes form. And so with the wonders of modern technology and the fact that we can layer information on each other, if you were to take an image like that and then layer on where the earthquake activity has taken place, that can kind of give you kind of an overall view of where maybe some of the pressures have been released through earthquakes and maybe were some areas that may be more susceptible.
If we had a local tsunami, what kind of warning time would there be? I mean, if we have one coming from Japan, from a Japanese earthquake, we've got hours and hours and hours. The news media can get set up and put their cameras on it, and then it's a small wave that... The last one was kind of anticlimactic, as I remember. But how much time would we have?
It can be on the order of minutes. It depends on where this actual event is taking place. Distant tsunamis, obviously, you have hours to prepare. You can get warnings out, as you said, and have time to make those preparations. A locally generated tsunami, you know, there's certain rules in terms of how much shaking occurs. You know, if there's 20 seconds of shaking, you should move immediately inland and up, you know, an elevation type of thing. And if the shaking is so much that it knocks you off your feet, that, you know, that could really potentially be a problem. But there's other factors that have to be considered as well. The depth of the water has, you know, something to do with that as well. So if you had an underwater landslide in a very shallow area of water, you know, it would generate an increase in water level, but it would be fairly minimal. So you have to take into account lots of different factors in determining what
very
the risk
what
would
Amy
be.
Was saying.
Exactly.
Each windstorm is different from the last one.
Exactly.
Each tsunami would be different.
And in the Juneau area, because generally speaking, you know, right near the city, the bathymetry is relatively shallow. It's not, you know, extraordinarily deep. One of the more probable impacts from a tsunami in this area, very locally to Juneau. Southeast, there are many other areas that are a much greater danger. But specifically to Juneau, the thought is that really it's a harbor. It's the harbor that would have the greatest impact. And so in many ways, you know, that's good for, you know, a portion of the community as far as where the infrastructure is. But certainly your harbor is a critical part and a bustling part of your community here. And so not just the tsunami wave coming in, but also the strong currents that are coming in and out of this narrow channel would be very hazardous to boats and anybody that's, say, for example, on the docks. I mean, that would be a more probable likelihood if Juneau was to see a tsunami.
So we established the fact that broadcasters are probably going to sound alerts and like that. My next question goes to, I guess, the other side of your service thing. What can we clients, we customers, what can we do to make your job easier, to make what you're trying to do with making us weather aware? How can we help that?
Oh, so many ways. I know the forecast office in Juneau is very active in recruiting what we call storm spotters. And Joel, the warning coordination meteorologist at the office, will go around the communities and train volunteers to, you know, be observers of certain weather phenomena and how to report those back to the forecast office. So that helps us essentially get it right. And you know, you can't cover every square mile with an observation of ground truth. And so it's kind of like a grassroots but very, very important way to be a good member of the weather community, I guess you could say. It helps us fill in some of those observation gaps and ultimately improve the forecast accuracy. And then also, if there's a talk that's about preparedness, whether it's through a local community club like a Rotary or something of that sort, come on over and have a listen. And, you know, they have some really excellent speakers here.
I guess the final question I would like to ask you, Jeffrey, is because your specialty is the science and the environmental. We have students who are active in the sciences. If a student is interested in going towards a career in weather forecasting, what should they concentrate on, maybe at the high school level?
Oh, I think, you know, concentrating on any of the environmental and physical sciences, you know, is really important. You know, I had a love of meteorology from back in grade school, and I think some of those core courses that I can actually point back to were some of the courses that helped to guide me into pursuing a degree in meteorology. So I think it's just kind of a love of science in general, and I say go for it. You know, we need more younger, you know, students coming up through the ranks to take over as we get older and eventually retire as well. And it's a fun job. It's a very rewarding job, and can't say enough about it.
Amy Fish, Decision Support Strategies Implementation Manager, and Jeffrey Oshinsky, Deputy Chief of the National Weather Service's Environmental and Scientific Services Division. Thank you so much for coming to Juneau, and thank you so much for giving us this information.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Recent Broadway smash and a world premiere. Perseverance Theater's 34th season, Oklahoma, Betrayal, Seminar, The Road Weeps, The Well Runs Dry, and Of Mice and Men. This season's plays take you on an amazing journey with stories of discovery, friendship, and love. Subscribe today for great savings, the best seats, and generous exchange privileges. For more information, visit perseverancetheater.org or call 463-TIXS.
It's about 11 minutes before 4 o'clock, and as always on Tuesdays, we have a representative of the school system to come in and tell us about one of the things that's of great interest to the Juneau schools. Lori Scandling, the assistant superintendent, is with us today, and she's going to tell us about the AVID program.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about that, but also, Pat, if you do have other questions that you'd like to ask me, I'd be happy to respond if I can. I want to tell you quickly about AVID. AVID is an acronym for Advancement Via Individual Determination. This is a program that is in its 33rd year, started by a teacher in San Diego when she noticed that there were some kids kind of beating the odds, meaning typically immigrant children or children of immigrants for whom there had not been a college-going or college-preparatory culture in their family, and yet there were kids who academically could be capable and were capable with additional support and guidance on how to navigate the academic system, whether it's taking notes or how to apply for post-secondary education. And this teacher put together really a series of strategies, and it is distilled into what's called the AVID elective. So kids in middle and high school take one period of their day, it's all voluntary, where they learn organizational skills, where they learn how to conduct themselves in an academic setting, how to pace themselves and manage homework, how to interact with teachers when they don't understand something, and how to tutor each other in a collaborative setting to really more deeply understand core content. And by core, I mean your language arts and your math. And the goal is for these kids, if they care to be ready to confidently and competently go on to college when maybe that hasn't been something that their family has experienced. So we're in our third year in Juneau of implementing AVID. It's in about 4,500 schools across the country now. And part of AVID involves having volunteers. I say volunteers, but we do pay $15 an hour. Folks who are interested in facilitating small groups of students in the AVID elective time in a study process to help them dig more deeply into a point of confusion they might have about one of the classes that they have, whether it's, say, science or math. And the facilitator, or as we call it, the AVID tutor, doesn't need to know that content area. What you really need to know is how to collaborate with and facilitate a group of teenagers. And we're doing some training on what they call AVID tutorology this Friday and Saturday. It's free, and you can participate in the training, and you don't have to be an AVID tutor to go through the training. What it will do is give you a pretty good look inside what AVID's all about and what that tutor does during that small group facilitation process in the AVID elective in our high schools and middle schools. We have, golly, this year we have over 200 students, probably 250 kids in grades 7 through 11 in an AVID elective, and all sixth graders get a quarter of the AVID organizational skills and strategies, learning strategies, as a quarter-long elective this year, so all sixth graders can get exposed to it, because middle school kids aren't the most organized beans on the planet, and so we are trying to be more ubiquitous with the strategies as kids enter middle school. And we do have one elementary school, Riverbend, which is piloting it with fourth grade. And that means everybody in the class learns some skills. You don't take an elective, obviously, in elementary school. Anyway, the training's at the Bill Ray Center. Starts at 8:30 Friday.
P.M.
And 8:30 Saturday. Nope, in the morning.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And it will go until about 4 on Friday, and we'll be done at 1 on Saturday. And AVID, as a national organization, really emphasizes fidelity of the implementation of its strategies. It's not a program, it's not a curriculum, it's a series of strategies that research shows helps boost that kind of invisible kid up with the opportunity to really strengthen skills that leverage them into some post-secondary. So we'd love to have people join the training. They should call the following number if they'd like to, because we do serve a lunch and we do provide the materials. And we would need to know, you know, how many folks to be ready for. And the number is 523-1737. And we very much enjoy having folks check out AVID. Again, it's not an obligation at all. We do trainings twice a year, and often of the 15, 16 folks who go through training, probably, half of them become AVID tutors. I will say this, so we have many tutors returning, which speaks to, I think, the challenge and joy they find in working with youth who want to be successful and aren't quite sure how. So it's a neat opportunity for community members. We encourage college students, retired people, perhaps parents who are stay-at-home parents, but their kid is at school during the day. And the Avid Tutor opportunity is a few hours a week. It's kind of spread throughout the week at different times, depending on a particular school's schedule and when that elective period happens. So it's not a full-time job. It's maybe a couple hours a week. So neat opportunity, and would love to host the community if we can know how many people might be attending.
While you were describing it, I was sitting here thinking the only way I survived my higher education was through collaboration.
Thank you for that.
Cooperate to graduate was what we called it.
It
was the only way you could survive. I mean, there was always somebody in a class who had more, who was getting it better.
Right.
And sometimes it was me, and sometimes it was somebody else, and I was struggling. But we saved each other. Literally, we would pick each other up by the bootstraps and haul ourselves through the class together.
Avid does. And during that elective time, you may have 8 kids struggling with a mathematics concept and another 5 struggling with an essay they're doing for an English class and another couple in a biology concept where it's not quite clear. But you put those kids together, and as you say,
they teach each other.
Collaborate to graduate. And that's exactly the foundation of the tutorial process. The adult really doesn't give answers. The adult facilitates a process so that clarity about what you're stuck on is distilled, and the members of that small group have a chance to help the person who's presenting their point of confusion at that moment.
I think the other part of this is that students, because of the potential for cheating and like that, are almost warned against working with each other. And really, I learned much more from my peers in my whole education than I ever learned from the classes. The professors were fonts of knowledge, and they had wonderful things to tell us, but they fed it to us. We had to struggle with it, and the learning process was really in the trenches, and we helped each other. That was exactly how we did it, and I think that goes right down to the fourth grade, right down to the second
Absolutely.
Grade.
Absolutely. One of the acronyms used inside of AVID is, WICOR, WICOR, and those are the foundational pieces of AVID: writing, inquiry, collaboration, organization, and reading. Mm-hmm. And if you can do those things well, you're ready for whatever your choice is after high school. And every kid deserves to be ready to make a choice that they feel confident about going into. And AVID says clearly they want to ready kids for college. We clearly know not all kids go to college, but that's not our decision. We need, as an institution of education, to make sure every kid is ready to have a whole variety of choices,
whether it's college or not.
Exactly.
We never stop learning, and there are no jobs that don't require you to learn. There are no activities in your life that
Absolutely.
Will not require you to learn.
You look at some of the technical training now. I visited we had a technical career fair over at the UAS tech building there across from JDHS, and I was blown away by some of the textbooks to learn, for example, something like sheet metal, quite technical.
Oh, yeah.
And if you do not have skills with technical reading, taking notes, and summarizing information, you might not get a job in a field that you might think is just a labor field.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so the training is Friday and Saturday. It starts at 8:30 in the morning on Friday at the Bill Ray Center. It lasts until 4 in the afternoon. Then it comes on again at 8:30 on Saturday morning and lasts until 1. You need to call 523-1737 if you want to make sure you've got a lunch and a book reserved.
Yep.
And people who are interested in spending an hour here and there and bringing some kids along with WICOR, then that's
nice
the opportunity
summary,
that's
Pat.
Here.
Nice
yeah.
summary.
Okay,
very
thanks,
good.
Lori, for coming
down.
Andy Klein will be hosting the show tomorrow, and he has a lineup of guests that include Skip Scheel, who's doing multimedia presentations in town, the Peace Park dedication. Rabbi Dov Gartenberg will be back. He'll be here to highlight the Jewish holidays that are coming up, and we'll hear from Ranger Doug of Riders in the Sky. Writer's Almanac, music, more, all that tomorrow when Andy Klein hosts Juno Afternoon. This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and we also broadcast on a set of translators throughout the area in the Valley and Auk Bay. You can tune K276AF. It transmits on 103.1 on your FM dial. We're on 101.7 in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek. The transmitter is K269AO. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.5, and 89.9 is the magic number in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, where they hear KTOO over translator K210AS. We're also on GCI Cable Juno Digital Channel 871, and 872 and 873 are KRNN and KXLL, and we stream the show continuously on www.ktoo.org.